Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. People from across the country in large and small cities are still taking to the streets to demand justice for George Floyd and to stand against police brutality and racial injustice. Joining us to talk about coverage of these massive ongoing protests are three guests. Ellie Mistel is the nation's justice correspondent covering the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics. Ellie is also an Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Type Media Center. Hi, Ellie. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Martin Reynolds is director of Reveal Investigative Fellowships. Martin is a senior fellow for strategic planning at the Robert C. Maynard Institute for Journalism Education and co-founder of Oakland Voices, a community storytelling project that trains residents to serve as community correspondents. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Darwin Bond Graham is news editor for Oaklandside. Darwin has been reporting on the ongoing protests in Oakland and has been covering the Oakland Police Department for years. Thank you, Darwin, for joining us, and thank you so much for connecting us with some youth activists yesterday. They were really amazing.
Good to be here, and you're welcome.
Great to have you. Well, I want to start off by just asking you all a basic question. The sheer size of these marches. Anne Helen Peterson is a culture writer at BuzzFeed. She's been keeping track of where these protests are taking place. In small, many mostly white cities across the country, Highland, Illinois, population 9,800. As someone tweeted, as the first African-American in that town back in the 80s, it's outstanding to see you guys showing out today. Never in my life would I have thought you would ever do something like this. The town went from protesting to remove my brother and myself to you taking to the streets. It's just happening in place after place. Howell, Michigan, former home of the KKK Grand Dragon, a number of people took to the streets there. Darwin, first off, what's your overall reaction to the sheer size of these protests?
It's incredible. These are very large protests, and the suddenness with which they were organized, the organic speed is incredible. And it's right. Those observations are absolutely correct. It's not surprising to see a massive protest in Oakland or San Francisco. It's very surprising to see large protests in places in like the North Bay and Santa Rosa, or in smaller cities across the Bay Area and across the United States. It's just phenomenal.
A lot of people were out in Healdsburg last night also. What would you add, Ellie? One more I'll read from Anne's tweet. Cabot, Arkansas. People were godsmacked by the turnout. Everybody I've spoken to, this is according to a tweet, it was just shocked. This is a tiny city in Arkansas, and so many people turned out.
Yeah, I think, look, it's positive that people are activated and are paying attention to this. These are issues that people in the African-American community have been talking about for some time. You could go back, 400 years and talk about how justice was necessary. So I'm kind of glad that more people than usual seem to be focused on the issue now. I need them to continue to be focused on the issue in the weeks and months after now, because that's what it's going to take to have real long-lasting police reform.
Mm. Martin, what would you add?
Well, I'm kind of looking at this, our work with the Maynard Institute is really focusing a lot on pushing for diversity in news organizations, and there's a real ongoing lack of that. And I think we've had a number of panels. Yesterday we did one with the investigative reporters and editors. We had 400 people on a Zoom call with some great guests from the Center for Investigative Reporting and KQED and other places talking about how this is being covered. And I think for my purposes, I'm sort of looking at the journalistic side and this being a moment where we're asking ourselves the question, to what extent is mainstream and traditional media complicit in our tacit willingness to simply cover these institutions as we have for so long, and that there is a conversation that's going on within the journalistic community about if we're not challenging policing or these other institutions that perpetuate structural racism, then what are we actually doing and what are we saying? And I think what has really come to the fore is that journalists of color within these institutions are pushing back, saying, you know, we can no longer simply cover this the way we have been covering it, covering policing the way we have been covering it. We have to start pushing against these structures, these institutions, especially at a time when so much change is going on in terms of how news organizations are seeking to be in a relationship to community, as economic models are changing, and there's a greater effort to ask news organizations to support the news gathering process. Well, how are you going to do that if you lack diversity and you have been covering communities in a way that is inaccurate and portrayals that actually put them at harm?
Well, yesterday you tweeted journalistic reflections for the day. Are we the problem? Is journalism part of a system of racism and white supremacy? If yes, then we have an obligation to journalistically challenge that system. If we do not, we are complicit. If you say no, then we need to talk now.
That's right. So in other words, give me a call now, because something must be wrong with you, because you're clearly not looking at what journalism has been doing for so many years. The way in which news organizations had covered diverse communities have been co-creators with police departments. I mean, let's be real. The way we will quote a police department and get its specific account far quicker than we will often quote a person in the community who doesn't have an official title. So the very structure of the way we look at community versus institutions is problematic.
Can I piggyback on what Mark is saying? Because
I think
one of the critical issues here in terms of concrete steps going forward is simply would be to get journalism organizations, media publications to look at a police report critically, because they haven't done that. They tend to repurpose a police report like a press release with no investigation, assuming that the police are telling the truth. Now, with the advent of the camera phone, with the advent of video, they have direct proof that the police will lie about what has happened, right? We saw it yesterday in Buffalo, where everybody saw the video of them pushing this elderly man down and cracking his head open. When you read the police report, it said the man tripped, right? So, like, this is the kind of lie that is inherent to a lot of police reports that the media simply repurposes and republishes uncritically. If that was the only change from this specific moment of protest, that would be a useful change.
Right. And in Buffalo, those two officers were suspended without pay.
Yes. Fine. Yes. As the video came out, and I know that I live in New York, and I know that New York AG Trish James is aware of the video and is looking at the video. So hopefully there will be justice for that. But again, when you read what the actual police said about that incident, they said the man got into an altercation with protesters, which didn't happen, and that he tripped. We see this. We have seen this consistently in general with the police, with the response to police brutality at the protests of police brutality, where we see cops hitting people, beating people, and yet their reports about what happened simply contradict the direct video evidence that we're seeing of their actions.
Darwin, you have been covering the Oakland PD for years. What would you add to this?
Oh, wow. A lot. you know, I generally agree with these critiques of the media. The media writ large can do a much better job of critically reading police reports, not treating statements that the police make as if they're objective and accurate, but treating them like everyone else, like they have a standpoint. You know, in what happened in Oakland since last Friday, when there was a large protest and essentially a fight between protesters and police, and large-scale property destruction and many arrests, I was struck walking the lines of police officers. There were cops out there policing this protest who personally have a history of killing young black men in the streets of Oakland in highly questionable circumstances. There was one officer on the front lines of a scrimmage line on Friday evening who was in two questionable shootings. The Oakland Police Department attempted to actually fire that officer. He won his job back through arbitration, a process which has been criticized and for which Oakland was found, the Oakland City Attorney was found to be unprepared and sort of sloppily presenting these discipline cases for years. There was the commander of one of the evenings, I believe it was Saturday night, one of the command staff who was out walking the police lines in Oakland was an individual who shot and killed Gary King Jr. in, I think it was 2006 or 2007. That was a highly controversial shooting of Gary King, of an African-American man. It was a case of mistaken identity, essentially, a potentially racial profiling. But that officer was never disciplined. He's a sergeant. He was leading the Oakland police response to some of these protests the other night. This sort of older generation of officers who escaped accountability, even with some of the critical media reporting back then, and comparing that today to the speed with which some of these officers that we've seen on camera committing these egregious abuses against protesters and also just against everyday people, that to me appears to be something of a shift. But I'm not going to credit the media and I'm not going to credit the police for making that shift. It's obvious that shift is due to the protesters themselves and the sharing of grassroots media, cell phone videos, and demands for change.
Right, because that has really had an influence. Obviously, the cameras have just completely changed the way that this is all handled, but also what people post on social media. What if we hadn't known? What if we never saw that older man got pushed down in Buffalo?
Yeah, we would only have the police report and maybe some eyewitnesses. And another thing, the journalism itself has undergone so many cuts in recent years. There's very few local reporters left who can do the hard work of tracking down an eyewitness to an incident like that. So yeah, without the cell phone video, it's possible that incident could have just been a elderly person tripping and injuring himself instead of what it really was.
I mean, look, without camera phones, George Floyd would be, a criminal who was resisting arrest who got what he deserved, right? Like without the video, the police would have gotten away with killing him and no reporter would have challenged that, right? No reporter would have done the legwork, and in part because local media, the cuts and the disruption that we've seen with the press, but nobody would have done the investigation to even get the eyewitnesses there at the store that saw something different. Without the video, George Floyd's murder is a justified killing and nobody really knows about it.
Mm. Yeah, what would you add about that, Martin? Some people are saying it's a tough one because seeing this video on social media over and over again is pretty traumatizing, yet you need it because, like Ellie said, we might not even know George Floyd's name today if it weren't for that video. Taken by a young woman who just happened to be in the area, we should say, who that experience alone has really traumatized her.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a very good point. There comes a point where I was actually having a conversation with a couple colleagues about this today, some journalism educators and working journalists about, well, at what point is the showing of the video too much? And my take has always been, when I was at the Tribune, was I always took some exception with the notion that we didn't show bodies, that we would say, like, I don't think things should be gratuitous, but I think even as you think about the history of war coverage, right? I mean, I think the tide in the Vietnam War was really turned when you saw these images of these American soldiers. And over the years, more and more war has been sanitized, and what we end up seeing are, you know, flag-covered coffins, which, you know, denote this patriotism and regalness to it, and there's nothing that's regal about war and death. And so I think so, too, when you think about the coverage of these kinds of issues and the humanity that is lost when someone is killed, I do think journalists have an obligation and news organizations have an obligation to show some of that carnage, because when we don't, we are sanitizing the implications of this for community and for our society and for our world. And so I think that, you know, think about Emmett Till, his mother wanting to make sure that when her child, the brutality that Emmett Till suffered at the hands of these racist men in the South was shown for all to see, and it really sparked a movement. And so, too, I think when you think about the coverage of George Floyd, seeing his last breath pressed out of him, the callousness that the officer showed with his knee on his neck and his hand in his pocket and his, you know, those sort of special police shoes that they have on, it was graphic, disturbing, and I think there does come a time when you can stop showing it, and maybe we're there now, but I don't think we do a service to society when we keep those images from the people we're seeking to serve.
Darwin, what would you add?
I largely agree with that. You know, I think the other calculus here is that the media is no longer in control of what images are shown or are not shown. You know, in the era of broadcast television and the, you know, local newspaper monopoly, yeah, certainly it was up to a handful of editors and reporters to decide, you know, what ended up on the nightly news. You know, thinking about, for example, the videotape of the Rodney King beating, right? This is before the internet, really, and well before cell phones and all that. And so for that video, you know, it was a purposeful decision of, you know, a relatively small handful of media organizations to really make it an image that was burned into the minds of Americans. But today, virtually everyone in America, millions of people have these computers in their pockets that are connected to the internet in real time with a video camera on them, and they are going to constantly share over social media these images, these very disturbing images of black bodies, black and brown bodies being brutalized by the police and just experiencing all the forms of systemic racism in America, and we cannot turn away from it now, and it's really not even up to the media anymore. If there's anyone who can make that decision at this point, it's probably the social media platforms themselves. But it's hard to even imagine them trying to, really, I don't think anyone expects Facebook, you know, or Twitter or anyone to make a informed decision, editorial decision about those types of things. The platforms themselves kind of shy away from that.
But one place that where the media, or the legacy media, still does have an important role is in providing the context for the video. Mm-hmm. And they use that importance, they use that role to provide more often than not, the cop context or the assailant context. We saw with the Ahmaud Arbery video, we saw television news anchors and reporters repeatedly say, well, we don't know what happened before the video, as if there was something that happened before the video that could justify the lynching, right? With the George Floyd video, we saw television news anchors and lots of reporters say, well, this video only, we don't know what happened before that led to this encounter. No, we don't know what happened before. What we do know is that officer sat there for 8 minutes with his knee on his neck. There is a desire, there is a both-sidism desire that is so ingrained in the press that even when they see an atrocity in front of their face, they have to add in, they have to say somewhere that maybe that atrocity was justified somehow. Mm-hmm. And that is something that needs to be addressed, right? That needs to be addressed at the highest levels throughout all legacy media. Why do you keep having people on? Why do you keep having reporters on? Why are they trained in such a way out of an abundance of whatever, to always try to justify atrocities when the victim happens to be black or brown.
Martin, yeah. What would you add there?
Well, I would add that, I mean, this goes back to a lot of the training that we try and do in news organizations around the fault lines, the framework that we teach, that we all see the world through the prism of race, class, gender, generation, geography, sexual orientation, and orientations, and the fissures of religion and politics and even ability, and that how you align across those social fault lines impacts how you see the world and creates bias. And these biases manifest themselves, whether it be affinity bias, in particular unconscious bias, and what ends up happening is this notion of objectivity that was just being alluded to is really a fallacy, right? Because none of us are objective, and how we align across these social fault lines impacts how we see the world. And as I can also tell you, as an African American man, I'm certainly not objective about the death of George Floyd, and in some eyes of editors, then that might make me unfit to do a story, right? Because so often what ends up happening in communities with journalists of color is that they have to go into these legacy news organizations and then conform. It's almost like that's what I was talking about in that tweet, these notions of institutions, right? That you may have people of diverse backgrounds entering institutions, police officers who are diverse entering into these institutions. But what ends up happening is the gaze of that institution is what ends up having to be what people conform to and then see community through. And so unconscious bias manifests itself really in four ways. There's a lack of information about a particular issue. There's stress from competing tasks. There's time pressure. And often there's an existing lack of diversity. Now, does that sound like any place that journalists work? So the very place that journalists work in doing their job are the very places where unconscious bias is most likely to emerge, and these inaccurate portrayals and this approach to communities of color, and particularly black men, will manifest themselves and those kind of caveats that the previous speaker was just alluding to.
I think it's so important to talk more about conforming, because if you diversify your staff, but they lack independence or they have to follow the script, it doesn't, at least on the radio, for example, it doesn't sound different. So we'll talk about that after the break. But I know we have to let you go, Darwin. What are your thoughts just in terms of, you know, working for more of an independent outlet? You're able to really bring in the context that Martin and Ellie are talking about.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we're doing that. And also because we're a very local outlet, right? We're obsessed with our city. Hopefully we're more accountable, or we'll be held accountable by the community that we're grounded in, right? And, you know, we're trying to build a more genuinely diverse newsroom so that we don't fall into these bubbles of bias, these silos, right? We're trying to build something different with the organization that I'm a part of. But that said, you know, it's an incredible task, because every institution in our society is, you know, has systemic bias built into it. And I think that, to me, that's part of what these protests, the widespread nature of them, is sort of driving at. This is very much about police brutality, in particular against black people in America. But to me, it feels like there's something broader here, and it's also, yeah, it's a frustration or a rage, a need for many of our institutions to change, and that includes the news media.
Darwin Bongram is news editor for Oakland Side. He's been reporting on the protests in Oakland and has been covering the Oakland PD for years. And he has a great piece about the student-led protest in Oakland a couple of days ago. Thank you again for joining us, Darwin, and thanks for your work.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with Martin Reynolds, Director of Reveal Investigative Fellowships and Co-Executive Director at the Robert C. Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, and Ellie Mistel, the nation's justice correspondent. This is your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about media coverage of the massive uprisings happening across the country over the death of George Floyd. People are standing up against police brutality, racial injustice, and many other issues. People are really connecting the dots and trying to get their stories out. What are your thoughts on the coverage? TV, radio, what you've been reading, what stands out for you? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Today, we are joined by Ellie Mistel, the nation's justice correspondent covering the courts, the criminal justice, and politics. He's an Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Type Media Center. We're also joined by Martin Reynolds, director of Reveal Investigative Fellowships, co-executive director of the Robert C. Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, and co-founder of Oakland Voices, a community storytelling project that trains residents to serve as community correspondents. Now I would like to welcome Gabe Schneider to the show. Gabe is MinPost's Washington correspondent. Hi, Gabe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, great to have you. You wrote a piece about what we've been talking about, who exactly is telling this story. You wrote it for Medium, and you write, "American journalism, a field mostly staffed by white reporters, for years has refused to collectively decide what truth to tell, the one journalists believe they see with their eyes or the one they hear from the black people that they cover. It's far more comfortable for many journalists to simply look and not ask, to write what officers of authority tell them and not question what outcome that leads to when reporting it out, to publish mugshots without considering the repercussions, to trust those with the legal power to enact violence rather than those without." This is exactly what we've been talking about, Gabe, and just what you have seen this week and, you know, 2 weeks, for example. What really strikes you about the coverage and what really prompted you to write this piece?
I think what strikes me about the coverage is that it feels the same as it felt, you know, the time before this happened and the time before that happened. We've seen, you know, weeks like this before where someone has been killed either by a police officer or particularly a black person, obviously, has been killed by a police officer, or someone has been killed in the streets and folks have come out and protested. And what we've heard from news outlets, particularly news outlets around the country that have been historically staffed by white reporters, is the passive voice, right? It's like you saw in the AP, there was a headline that was, "Minneapolis cop who knelt on George Floyd's neck, arrested." It's not, you know, "Minneapolis cop who killed George Floyd." It was, "Oh, he knelt on his neck." And so you see this sort of same thing playing out over and over again of legacy outlets covering things in the passive voice and covering things without any sort of substantive historical framework when trying to explain police power.
You know, Martin, you brought up the conferences, and every conference I go to, there's always one diversity panel, mm-hmm. and the guests say they have great things to say, but it's almost like again and again and again, and whatever changes. You know, you might bring in a couple more journalists of color. Oh, there's a new host at a national show who's a journalist of color. But you've been doing this for a while. You've been going to these conferences for many years. Based on what, you know, what we've all been talking about here, what has really changed?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. And one could feel a sense of despair, and there still is a lot of reasons to be frustrated, particularly with traditional legacy media. But the hopeful tone that I have is that there over since this sort of decimation of traditional news organizations and newspaper chains and the like, what has begun to sprout up are these independent and nonprofit media organizations. Now, I don't mean to in any way say that they have solved the diversity problem, because they haven't. In many instances, they're not particularly diverse at all. But there seems to be a growing understanding that there is a need, and they don't have the same legacy challenges. They're smaller, able to move. And so in places like the Center for Investigative Reporting, Reveal, where they now have Matt Thompson there, who's the first African-American man to lead the organization, Center for Public Integrity now has an African-American woman, Susan Smith Richardson, working there as its CEO, and is able to make some hiring decisions. Also, in the nonprofit journalistic space, foundations like the Knight Foundation, like Ford Foundation, like Democracy Fund, are really beginning to push these organizations that they give money to have some real plans about what their diversity metrics are going to look like. So I think there is some movement in this direction, and even an organization like Cal Matters, which covers politics across the state of California, is about 40% people of color. Now, it's operating in a state that's 60% people of color, but 40% people of color in your news organization is a high percentage when most news organizations, legacy, according to the Newsleader Association last census, is about 20%, 16 to 20%. Mm-hmm. So I think there is progress, but yes, you go to the diversity panel and there's like six people there, or it's all people who care about this very issue. But I think this is a moment. I think it's an inflection point for our country, not only in terms of addressing these systems, but also within journalism. I don't know what's going to happen, but my sense is, and the last point that I'll make here, is that there's also a pivot, particularly in for-profit media, to move away from advertising models to subscriber models. And some of the work we're doing with the Table Stakes Initiative is getting news organizations to think about how diversity, equity, and inclusion is tied to sustainability, and that you cannot expect people from diverse communities to support your news gathering if you are not going to reach out to them and to cover the community and to co-create in the way that the Oakland side approach to building beat structures and even its name has really taken on. So I'm really heartened by what's going to happen in Oakland with the Oakland Side Project, because the way they have approached thinking about beats, thinking about the organization, is the way in which news organizations should approach it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ellie, what would you add, especially when you think about how media outlets function within this existing business model?
Exactly. I want to come back to the point that we said before the break about conformity. I mean, look, I went to Harvard College and Harvard Law School. Conformity is my native tongue, all right? Like, I know from being inside a box. And the thing that really strikes me as we talk, as in my own career, as I transition into media, as I look at the media landscape, it's that it is the conformity of these organizations that bleaches, if you will, the diversity that they are willing to hire, right? So that even if, you know, you can get a job at the New York Times as a person of color, you can get a job at NPR as a person of color, you just have to sound like the New York Times. You just have to sound like NPR. What you can't do is bring your full self. Like, what they should be hiring you to do is to bring your full self. But as soon as you kind of get in there, that's the thing they don't want. That's the thing that they don't want to hear. And that to me is a huge part of the problem, because everybody wants to succeed, right? Everybody wants to be respected and to do well at their job. And if you tell people of color the way to do well at your job here is to sound like everybody else, well, you know, a large percentage of them are going to choose to sound like everybody else, right? Charles Blow is a hero. Everybody can't be him, though, right? Everybody can't break from that mold like he tries to do, I think, in his columns, like Mara Gray tries to do, I think, in her columns. So I think that's a huge thing. If I was going to strike a hopeful note, I would, like Martin did, I would look at my own career and say that one of the things that has helped me is the decentralization of the media, right? Like, my career is not possible, at least in the way that I've done it, in a kind of legacy media 1984 media landscape. I started at a blog, right? I have a Twitter following. I have all of these other ways and abilities and outlets to be my full authentic self, that I was able to show that full authentic self could get clicks that then made me kind of hireable and hireable in a way that's like, well, let him do his thing. He's right. Proven that his thing can work. That's been important for my career. And I think that there are a lot of journalists of color who are trying to follow that path, where you kind of prove yourself outside of legacy media. And that then means that when you are kind of captured or brought into legacy organizations, you have a little bit more freedom to be yourself because you've shown the proof of concept.
Right, which is sad because could you be Ellie Mistel, this Ellie Mistel, if you were a justice correspondent for the New York Times?
Right. Not, I mean, not now, not today. Right. But it's proving that I can be this guy that makes it possible. I hope. I mean, this is the big hope that makes it possible for the next guy to be the justice correspondent in the New York Times and do it in their own way, as opposed to the way it's always been done.
What would you add to that, Gabe, especially around the issue of conformity? And then we can talk about objectivity.
I can piggyback on that and say, you know, I'm 2 years out of college, and it's been frankly extremely helpful for me to have folks like Ellie actually talk and speak to this. I think about Wesley Lowery, who was at the Post, who came out and essentially said, or at least it came out, that he was threatened with being fired for saying that the Tea Party stemmed, you know, from racism. And I think about folks like Kendra Pierre Lewis, who was at the New York Times, who said that she was sort of cited by their standards editor for writing about white supremacy on Twitter. And I'm incredibly grateful to these folks for sort of laying the groundwork for actually having these conversations, because it's frightening as you're trying to move into this media landscape to know that, you know, behind closed doors, a lot of these outlets don't want to hear what you have to say. And what you have to say when it comes to black reporters is often the truth when it comes to racism. And it's incredibly disappointing. And I'm grateful. And especially seeing what happened yesterday at the New York Times when black reporters sort of pushed back on the social media policy, potentially at the expense of their jobs, I'm grateful. And one more thing that I sort of think about is last year, a couple student journalists at the Northwestern started making standards changes to the way that they were doing their coverage. And a lot of these folks were journalists of color. They had a black editor-in-chief. And they were pilloried nationally for suggesting that, you know, maybe we need to have a little bit more empathy in our reporting. Maybe we need to blur protesters' faces when they're protesting, because maybe they're going to be punished by law enforcement or by the university. And I really would love to see not just empathy coming from, and not just an understanding coming from black reporters who are speaking out, but that coming from white reporters. And I would love to see an apology for the lack of folks that have spoken out, as well as the folks that sort of bashed those Northwestern students last year.
Well, and for people who haven't been following what's going on at the Times, and we can talk about this later, but I want to make sure we don't run out of time to focus on objectivity. Staff members at the New York Times, including a Pulitzer winner, are denouncing an essay, an op-ed that they published by Tom Cotton, a Republican of Arkansas, calling for a military response to the protests. And like I said, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but I want to make sure we spend some time on what objectivity really means. The Daily interviewed New York Times editor Dean Baquet a couple of months ago, and they were talking about, you know, lawmakers from the two parties. This was according to an article that got criticized. Lawmakers from two parties couldn't agree on a basic set of facts in front of them. And Dean Baquet endorsed what he called sophisticated true objectivity. And I'd like you all to talk about what you think objectivity means today, at a time when a lot of newsroom editors are talking to their reporters about objectivity and what they can and cannot say in public. Gabe, why don't you start off?
Sure. I think I'm lucky to be at an outlet that, you know, is smaller, but it's a nonprofit outlet that values my voice as a black correspondent, and, you know, lets me cover things for the most part as I want to in Washington. And when it comes to objectivity, I think there's been a failure for many, many years to recognize that when you're talking about objectivity, it's not like there was no sense of journalistic objectivity in the 60s when you didn't really have black journalists at papers. And then prior to that, when you didn't have, you know, women at some of these legacy outlets, there was still what was a sense of, you know, called objectivity then. And it's ridiculous to me now that reporters are still willing to commit themselves to the idea that objectivity doesn't come from, or at least what we understand as journalistic objectivity, doesn't come from the viewpoint of your own experiences and what you understand to be the way that the world works. I mean, the way that you frame stories comes out of your understanding of the world. And I think actually a really fantastic book on this is The View from Somewhere, Undoing the Myth of Journalistic Objectivity by Lewis Raven Wallace, who's done some really fantastic work on this subject. And there's also a podcast. So for folks looking to, I think, look into this a little more, and I've seen a lot of questions from folks at newsrooms who aren't really sure where to start, I think that's a really good starting point.
Yeah, and actually, Lewis and Ramona Marcia, I believe her name is, sorry if I didn't get her last name right, she worked on that too. And in a Journalist of Color Facebook page, she said, you know, we put this together knowing that we would never work for legacy media again, because we put too much out on the line doing this podcast. But it is such a good one, and I hope people can take the time to listen to it. Martin, what would you add?
Well, I appreciate what Gabe had to say, and it's excellent. Yeah, Lewis is fantastic and a great podcast. I would say, I mean, objectivity doesn't exist. We are not objective beings. How we view the world is shaped how we align across those social fault lines I mentioned earlier, and it impacts. It's why two people can look at the same issue and come away with very different perceptions about what they just saw. And it's, we do a disservice to the conversation in newsrooms and in news organizations when we don't recognize that, and we're certainly doing a disservice to the communities and to the issues, because I certainly, when I went to journalism school, was taught this notion of objectivity or journalistic objectivity, and what I evolved to understand later in my career and then instructed my reporters at the Oakland Tribune was to think, you know, you're not objective, but you can be fair. And what does fairness look like? And how are you being fair? Because this notion that we are sort of these blank slates that walk into these issues and just come, I'm a fly on the wall, and I have no preconceived notions and no bias as I step into look at a particular issue, is completely ridiculous, and I would say that it's actually dangerous. So the fact that there are still news organizations that are perpetuating this notion of journalistic objectivity without understanding how bias and the many kinds of bias, performance bias, affinity bias, implicit bias, unconscious bias, impact how we approach coverage, how we approach hiring and retention, how we approach the culture of news organizations. And the other part that I want to say is that, you know, we are no longer pushing for diversity in news organizations. What we are pushing as an institution, as an institute, is equity and inclusion in service of diversity. Because just diversity does not, what it ends up being are the people that are usually the most junior, the youngest, first hired, first fired, and they don't have the agency. So if you don't have equity, if you don't have inclusion, it really doesn't matter the kind of diversity that you have.
Hmm. Great point. Ellie.
I would add, look, I'm a columnist. I don't have to be objective. I like to say I am objective from my perspective. And that's really all I have to be. But the larger issue here, and it goes what to Martin just said, nobody is actually objective. People have to own that and understand that. Here's one thing that I do to kind of illustrates the point, right? I report on the Supreme Court a lot. I report on their rulings and their arguments. Whenever I have to say Brett Kavanaugh's name, the first time that I write it down in any article that I write it, I write alleged attempted rapist Justice Brett Kavanaugh. I write that every time. That is objectively true. He is objectively an alleged attempted rapist. That is a completely true and objectively so statement. Do I write it because I'm trying to be objective? Nah. Nah, I've got a bias there. I've got a point that I'm making there. There is a reason why I do that every time. A different reporter might refer to Brett Kavanaugh as Justice Brett Kavanaugh every time. That is also objectively true. But that reporter doesn't understand that they are also showing bias. That reporter doesn't understand that whenever they write Justice Brett Kavanaugh as opposed to Justice alleged attempted rapist Brett Kavanaugh, they are also showing bias, showing story selection, emphasizing what they think is important, and by omission, emphasizing what they think is not important. And so going, I think people have to be kind of more critical readers, obviously, but people also have to be more critical writers and more critical talkers and simply own their bias, own their lack of objectivity, understand what they are doing when they make choices, and, you know, live with it, defend it. Mm-hmm. I would rather have that. I would rather kind of argue with a Supreme Court reporter defending their biases as opposed to simply talking about mine, because I can defend mine, right? So that's what I think. I just think that it goes back to what Martin says. Nobody is actually objective. Some people just gotten very used to thinking they are.
Martin, how do you talk with the young people that you work with about this? Because I'm struck when young people come to KALW and they come to the studio, one of the first questions they ask us is about objectivity.
That's interesting. It's so pervasive. And Ellie, I just really love what you said. You just brought me joy with that. So when we, for instance, train our voices correspondents, so part of the reason, part of our thinking about it from an institute perspective that has really changed has really actually been brought about by working with people in the community and teaching them to be storytellers and actually valuing the fact that we're not trying to sort of mush them into the next cohort of journalism. Like, I think that one of the things that's so powerful about community storytelling initiatives is that you have the role that professional journalists play, which are considering we're trained, and it's a particular skill set and craft that we work hard to learn. But then you have folks who come from a different perspective, and where we're actually expecting them to not be objective, right? Because what they actually bring about the coverage of Oakland, for instance, is not objective. It's totally biased and towards their community, towards the issues they think are going uncovered. And so it's actually been that experience. And then we, of course, teach them journalistic skills, and we teach them how to go out and, you know, make things sure things are accurate and correct. And we have, like, had no corrections in 10 years of doing this program and no retractions. So they respect that. But what they have taught us is that there is such value in recognizing your perspective and how you see the world. And I think journalists would do well to learn from the people that they seek to serve, and to what Ellie said, is just embracing what biases you have, because what's dangerous is when you think you are a blank slate. That is what is most concerning.
We're going to do another show about this, and it's a big question, but I think about it a lot. At a time when we are seeing lines and lines, miles of cars, you know, waiting to get food, people struggling to make ends meet, so many people losing their jobs who make less than $40,000 a year, police brutality. I mean, the list just goes on and on. What is the role of a journalist today in a society that has so much inequality? Again, like I said, it's a huge question, but I think it's an important one, and I think we need to constantly ask ourselves this. As a young journalist, Gabe, how do you think about that?
I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, but I think for the most part, a good guideline is simply speaking truth to power. And what I mean by that is when, you know, you're covering protesters and you're deciding if a protester says to you, I don't want you to take a picture of my face, you should probably consider the fact that they're just a protester. They're just someone on the street, rather than a politician who might say, I don't want you to take a photo of me. If it's a politician and it's someone that has power, absolutely you can take a photo of them. Why not? But, you know, if it's just someone on the street, I don't understand why that would be necessary. And I think that same principle holds up pretty much across the board. We're here to hold people in power to account, whether that's police officers who have the power to inflict violence or politicians. And I would hope to see that level of coverage and framework come out from every outlet. And it's frankly, in the last few weeks, not something that I've seen, which has been incredibly disappointing.
I'm glad you said that, because it was disturbing to see MSNBC just hold their camera for, you know, minutes, 5 minutes, 8 minutes on people running in stores, people running around. They never asked anyone if they wanted to be on camera. I mean, that's for a different conversation, but it was pretty striking to see that. They didn't really talk to hardly anyone on the streets. Martin, what would you add?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Rose. I just think, I mean, I just no longer think that journalists, I mean, what has happened when I think about how journalism, you know, when I came into journalism many moons ago, you know, it felt like it was sort of more of a blue collar kind of gig, you know, and I think now people who are in this profession and they have a measure of privilege that I don't recall necessarily being there before. And I think that these institutions have to begin to look at themselves as, I took this training by Race Forward. So I do diversity training, but I want to take training from other people who do this. And they do it around social justice, the approach around social justice. And what they talked, they did a whole section on what the institutions were that are supporting, you know, racial oppression, white supremacy, and so on and so forth. And media was listed among them, right? This wasn't a training for journalists. This was people who worked in civil service. They worked for cities. They worked in the arts. They worked in all manner of businesses, not journalistic. And this is the framework that these trainers were giving to them, that our profession was a contributor, was complicit in the perpetuation of these systems that are keeping people disenfranchised. So I actually think, if we are going to be true to this notion of speaking truth to power, well, what does that look like when we essentially report on institutions as just that they're okay? Not all journalistic organizations do this. You know, the Marshall Project and many others. So there are niche publications, but I'm saying sort of legacy media writ large. So in my view, we have to begin to look differently in that. And if those organizations, those legacy institutions, aren't going to change their perspective, then maybe they need to go the way of the pterodactyl. And there's a whole new generation of young journalists, people coming up who are not having this anymore, because we are not doing our society and the world a service when we are perpetuating reporting that doubles down or is complicit in letting these systems continue as they are.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but Ellie, we will have you back for this conversation about what role a journalist should play today. What is our responsibility today? Martin Reynolds is co-executive director at the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education. Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ellie Mistel is a justice correspondent for The Nation. Thank you for joining us, Ellie.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Gabe Schneider is MinnPost Washington correspondent. Thank you for joining us, Gabe.
Thanks so much.
And thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.